international self-determination in his famous 14 points. And over the subsequent period, we've seen that principle cited in a great many different contexts, some of which haven't been particularly good at giving nationalism a good name. In all that time, genuinely democratic nationalism has been a rather rare and precious flower, by which I mean a nationalism that operates fully within a liberal democratic context, uses only peaceful and legitimate means, such as elections, to advance a national cause and demands for statehood, and fully respects the rights of all inhabitants of the designated national territory. Scottish nationalism meets these very stringent democratic criteria, and so it's a very important case for academics to study. So far, democratic nationalism has paradoxically not produced the separation out of national groups within established liberal democracies to form independent states. There are some examples of recently democratized states or partially democratized states fragmenting into distinct units. Czechoslovakia split into two separate countries shortly after the end of communist dominance, and of course Singapore left the Malaysian Federation in its early years. But in most cases where democratic nationalist parties have become politically important within established liberal democracies, independent states have not yet resulted. So we can think of Quebec, which remains a part of the Canadian Federation, of Belgium, where Flemish and French speakers still share some common central government, of Catalonia and the other autonomous communities of Spain, which continue to be part of a wider Spanish state. So some academics have speculated, as we like to do, that just as liberal democracies don't make war on each other, so perhaps democratic nationalisms will carry on in some way, transforming their parent states into ever more federal or confederal structures, but never quite make the final break for independence. And of course, because academics disagree, equally eminent authors have speculated the opposite and look forward to a coming age of small and flexible states operating within overarching regional bloc structures in the world, like the European Union. Well, tonight we are going to learn a great deal more about how Scottish nationalism's growth and development will shed light on these issues for Scotland and also for England and Wales, because we're honoured to have with us as our lecturer Alex Salmond, who is the national convener, which is the SNP word for leader, of the Scottish National Party. Mr. Salmond has played a vital role in the transformation of his party's policy positions and standing in the polls since becoming leader in 1990. The SNP is now very clearly Britain's fourth largest political party. It's got six Westminster MPs, two members of the European Parliament, and more than 200 councillors across Scotland. At times in recent months, the SNP has been the most popular party in Scottish opinion polls. And of course, it's running very hard for the May Scottish Parliament elections, where it looks certain to emerge either as the largest party or the second largest party. Alex Salmond's role in this transformation of the SNP's political fortunes is acknowledged by friend and foe alike to have been a crucial one. He's widely recognised as one of the most electorally effective, personally shrewd, and imaginative political leaders of his generation. He took his degree in economics from St. Andrews University, and he combines experience as an economist in the civil service and the Royal Bank of Scotland with nearly 12 years' experience now in the House of Commons. And yet, unaccountably, he tells me that today is the very first time he's been to the LSE. His theme tonight is Scotland in the Process of Independence.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, this is indeed the first time I've been to the LSE, although if the audiences are always as large as this one, then I'll probably come back. In fact, I might do all of my political speeches in England if this is the turnout that can be generated. It might have something about profits in their own country, perhaps. But I'm reminded, actually, of a story about a new moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. And this moderator came into office, and he wanted to start out his moderatorship by giving a new style to the Kirk. And so what he decided to do was to to make his first sermon, his first address to the Kirk and to the nation, from the smallest country church in the whole of Scotland. So that's exactly what he did. He turned up there, and it was a total disaster. I mean, two women and a dog turned up. And of course he had no choice. He went ahead with the sermon. He had to deliver it. And they went outside, said to the local minister, "This is a disaster. This is my first address to the church in the nation. Nobody has turned up. It's a total humiliation. For goodness sake, didn't you tell them I was coming?" To which the minister said, "No, but obviously word must have leaked out." So, word obviously didn't leak out today. And for those of you who think you're seeing train spotting in the screen, as I saw advertised, presumably not in my honour, as I came in then, my sincere apologies. But what I wanted to talk to you tonight is about Scotland, certainly, but about more than Scotland. This is one of a series of lectures which has been undertaken by people in the SNP, both in the mainland of Europe, elsewhere in England, in Ireland. A number of talks have been given, and it's an attempt to take not because we're lighting a fiery cross, but it's an attempt to take the message of the Scottish National Party, our ambitions, directly to audiences who will be obviously affected by success that we may have in the coming elections. And the St Andrews series, because we're collecting all these speeches together and in the way of the SNP selling them to interested parties, although I'm assured that you'll be able to have the text of this free on the LSE internet by the end of the day, apparently with moving pictures as well. I shall have to see that later on. I'll test it tonight to see if that boast comes true. But the St Andrews series is designed to take the SNP's very positive and constructive message of change to the rest of the United Kingdom, the rest of Europe, indeed, to the wider world. I would like to contrast it rather with the new Labour cabinet ministers who have been dispatched north in day return visits to Scotland, and their message is almost entirely negative, a gnat-bashing message. Actually, I quite enjoy the SNP bashing bit because that gives us lots of publicity, but it's worse than that. It's a message which is totally negative about Scotland's prospects, Scotland's abilities, and indeed in many cases about Scotland's future. I was interested in the Prime Minister's visit last November to the Dáil, and the contrast between what he said in the Dáil about Ireland's prospects and success as an independent nation within the context of Europe, and the highly constructive and positive way he put it, praising Ireland's entrepreneurs as the wonder of Europe at the present moment. He received a standing ovation in the Dáil, and I was contrasting that with the disparaging way he treats any suggestion that Scotland might emulate the same success as the other small nation of our western borders. Indeed, I challenged him in the House of Commons just before Christmas, and I made the point to him that, you know, because he was so positive and constructive about Ireland was why he received a standing ovation in the Dáil, and perhaps it was so negative and dismissive of Scotland's prospects was why he received the bum's rush in the North East of Scotland by-election. Now, occasionally in Hansard, I have a tendency, which I share with the Secretary of State for Scotland, to use Scots words. I mean, sleekit, for example, which means underhand and pretty slimy. I mean, no word better describes the government front bench, in my opinion. And when I use words like that, Hansard, you know, send me down a note, you know, saying sleekit, ? So when I said to the Prime Minister that he'd got the bum's rush in the northeast of Scotland Euro by-election, Hansard sent me down a note saying, "What is the Robert Burns rush?" But for all the dismissive and negative thinking, what I'd like to do, coming to the LSE today, is in contrast, speak positively and optimistically, not just about Scotland's prospects as a European nation, but about England's prospects and about the re-emergence that's possible of English identity after some generations under a relative cloud. Now, I'm not going to offer a formula for the people of England to follow. I'm merely going to offer some observations. Given that I'm very strong in the belief that the destiny of the people of Scotland should lie in the hands of all the people of Scotland, I obviously believe that the destiny of England should lie in the hands of all the peoples of England. But I'm going to offer one or two observations this evening about why I think independence for Scotland, which by definition means independence for England as well, is going to be a positive development for both nations and offers very substantial opportunities. George Robertson, who's now Defence Secretary, but before the election was the Shadow Secretary of State for Scotland, he once said that devolution would kill the SNP, as he put it, stone dead. And the builders of the Titanic thought the boat was unsinkable. It's not the greatest prophecy in Scottish politics in terms of its success. And I think the nervous pronouncements of the Prime Minister about the lasting nature of the devolution settlement, that this is a once-and-for-all settlement for all time, actually are in marked contrast to the expectations of people in Scotland. The majority of Scots believe that Scotland will be an independent nation within a 15-20-year period. In fact, the polls are overwhelming in that sort of timescale. Obviously, I'm advocating and hoping that it'll be rather sooner than that. But these expectations are there in the Scottish population. Now, expectations are a very powerful force in shaping the future, but in themselves, they don't make independence inevitable. The achievement of independence relies on the people of Scotland to embrace a new future and to make it work. My view is if the new Parliament works, and the more it works, and the better it works, and the stronger the desire for greater power will become. I believe it will lead to independence, and in that sense, I think Scotland is currently in the process of independence. One of the founders of the London Business School was the management guru Charles Handy, and he said, "We can influence the future if we know what we want it to be. We can and we should be in charge of our destinies in a time of change." This lecture tonight is about influencing the future. It's about being in charge of our destinies. It's about achieving the best for Scotland, including the best relationship we can possibly have with England and with the other nations who inhabit these islands. It's about more than Scotland, but it's also about how Scotland can do more. I would define the ideal relationship between the two nations of Scotland and England by the phrase good neighbours at home and partners in Europe. Partners in Europe and in the wider world, seeking the best for each of our countries. That is what we should aspire to, and that should be the keynotes of our partnership between our countries, shorn of the inequality of past relationships. It used to be said in Ireland that England's difficulty was Ireland's opportunity. I believe today that Britain's difficulty, the decline of Britishness, is England's opportunity. And as a Scot, I want to examine the opportunity this evening, because I believe that by seizing that opportunity, England can benefit from a new dynamism that constitutional change has released in Scotland. Now, there has been a growing sense of Scottish self-confidence over the past 30 years or more. Indeed, you could argue that this confidence began to express itself as early as the late 19th century, when the demands for Irish Home Rule began to be paralleled in Scotland. These demands were not insignificant, and they actually brought concrete political achievement. When the Office of the Secretary of State for Scotland was established in 1885, at a time when the founder members of the Independent Labour Party were including Home Rule as part of their election platform. Now, the strategic choice for Home Rulers became whether they should pursue their aims through the established parties or whether they should form a political entity. And that was solved or decided first by the establishment of the National Party for Scotland and then later with the formation of the Scottish National Party in 1934. The emergence of a political party with Home Rule, self-government, as a central plank of its policy, challenging the established parties on the electoral battleground, didn't, as to be said, unduly worry the major parties until perhaps the 1960s, although the SNP did briefly hold the constituency of Motherwell in the dying months of the Second World War. But it was Winnie Ewing's spectacular victory at Hamilton in 1967 which marked the start of continuous parliamentary representation for the SNP and marked the representation and growth of a party committed to constitutional change as a sine qua non of Scottish recovery. What I want to suggest this evening is that the days of boom and bust nationalism are over. There was times in the 60s and 70s where the SNP went up like a rocket and then down like the stick. The last few years have shown a sustained an enduring rise in support for the SNP and the claim of Scotland for independence, which has already achieved concrete political results and I believe will achieve a great deal more. In the 1970s, the Home Rule package was ambushed by Labour backswoodsmen, and the Thatcher government tore up the Home Rule proposal, despite promising during the devolution campaign in 1979 that they were campaigning against, because they were about to put something better in its place. But Scotland's sense of itself and sense of a potential of its future was formally confirmed in the referendum of 1997, when it answered in general terms the century-long question of what type of country it wished to be. And this is not a country forever tied to the United Kingdom, but one in which the Parliament would be limited only by the democratic assent of Scots. And that was the platform on which the 1997 referendum campaign was conducted by all of those who participated on the Yes side, although memories in some cases are beginning to get a bit selective 2 years later. Now, what is now taking shape in Scotland is a detailed answer to the same question. The election in 70 days' time will draw in on the Scottish political map the type of policies that will be pursued over the next 4 years and beyond, and the likely destination of our country. For the SNP, these policies have to be founded on the Scottish mainstream and the reawakening of the themes of enterprise, compassion, democracy, which I submit are the three pillars of Scottish identity and a Scottish sense of self-worth. Now, I'll return to these themes in a few minutes, but what I want to look at is, having given that pen picture of the development of Scottish nationalism, I want to look at the development of England over the same period. Because while the 20th century has been a period of slow discovery for Scots and slow discovery back to self-confidence in our identity, in England, to a certain extent, there has been a crisis of identity. Last century, Cecil Rhodes rhetorically asked the world what nationality it would aspire to, and then answered his own question by saying, 99 out of 100 will tell you that they would prefer to be English. That was Cecil Rhodes a century ago. But that self-confidence, which that quote reflected, it was not something that was sustained. I mean, in the latter part of this century, John Osborne, one of the most celebrated playwrights of England, actually got to the extent of talking about England, John Osborne did, as a country which was rotting and was about to disappear. And the important point is that to a certain extent he was celebrated, he achieved fame, critical of fame, not despite, but to a certain extent because of the very depressing view he had of England, Englishness, and England's prospects in the 1960s. There is very little dispute, in my view, that the post-imperial hangover often leaves England still with a sore head. The ludicrous construct of Cool Britannia, described memorably by Jeremy Paxman as being one in which any truly cool person could only wince or shudder, is truly another attempt to get away from the fact that the party is over. I helped Jeremy, I'll call him Jeremy, if you do that you get a news night quite a lot, they launch his book, The English in Scotland, just not long before Christmas, and I was had the delightful chance to ask him a few questions rather than the other way around. So after he'd given his presentation of what his book was about, I said to him, well, of course, Mr. Paxman, this book is basically a rather underhand way of making extensive profits in addition to your hyper-inflated BBC salary, is it not? To which he disarmed the audience by saying, of course it is. But that book, and certainly his assessment of Cool Britannia, is something which I share. And I also share the view that successive generations of Westminster politicians, Tory and Labour alike, have failed to come to terms with the reality of Britain as a medium-sized European country. And I'm going to suggest this evening that the ludicrous Millennium Dome is the apotheosis of this failure. The challenge and the opportunity facing England is to make the best use of its considerable riches, its formidable history of literary and political achievement, its great ingenuity and its great skill in order to pioneer a new European future alongside the other nations of these islands. Now, thinking about the dome, what does the dome actually celebrate? It's not coming to terms with the future, but there's some sort of grandiose vision of the contribution that Cool Britannia is going to make to a new world. It is the most extraordinary failure of imagination and moral conscience to assert that a glitzy tourist attraction built at vast cost is of greater importance to society than, for example, investing £750 million in education, health, the social services, in community activities. And yet by wasting these vast sums of money on the prestige project of the dome, that is exactly what the government is doing. But the dome sums up the central problem. Successive governments seek to create greatness in symbols and gestures as opposed to the substance of creating a society that is great to live in. And isn't the opportunity to create a great society, a society that judges itself by the excellence of its education, the compassion of its social services, by its entrepreneurial skill, by its democratic institutions, that has arisen, that opportunity in Scotland, which we are trying to move forward and to make real. By doing so, I think we open up an opportunity south of the border as well. The opportunity is to escape from the post-imperial malaise that still hangs over Downing Street and Horse Guards Parade. The opportunity to develop new productive relationships for the 21st century that are built on a shared vision of the future. Shorn of the mistakes of the past, Scotland and the Scottish Parliament can help show the way. Now, earlier this week, the Secretary of State for Scotland announced lottery grants for celebrating the millennium as part of a wider UK package. Welcome as though these projects were, many still bore the hallmark of a government obsessed with show but not substance. Over the past few weeks, I've visited a number of community and voluntary projects working at the sharp end of community and public need in Scotland. And like many of these projects, they're being squeezed out by the existence of local authority cutbacks and often by government indifference. So tonight I want to announce a new approach to the millennium. The Scottish Parliament will not be overflowing with resources, but as well as the funding already announced this week, we'll be making special arrangements to allocate an additional £5 million specifically for voluntary and community projects in the millennium year. These projects can tackle community need and reach into places where government presently hardly ventures. I'm challenging the private sector to match this funding so that we can celebrate the millennium in a manner which can touch those most in need and for those whom a dome in the Thames is as far out of reach as the man in the moon. The full details of the scheme will be announced by the SNP next week, but the principle of our Scottish millennium is to have a millennium celebration which is for all of the people, for the have-nots as well as the haves, and our millennium, through the impact on these community projects, will have a lasting effect on people's lives. Now, I'm certain that that type of approach to the millennium, rather than inflating a giant bubble in the Thames, reflects not just the people's priorities north of the border, but reflects the people's priorities south of the border as well. You know, there's been much talk in recent days in Scotland of concordats that the government is seeking to establish between the new Scottish Parliament and Westminster departments. These are being drawn up in secret in this very open government. But they seem to be designed to bind the new Parliament in even before it's been elected. What I'm saying this evening is we can aspire to much better than that. We should be aspiring to a new concordat between our two nations, one that adds to the process, momentum of discovering and securing the identity of both nations and defining the future for both, for all in these islands that we share and the continent to which we are tied. Now, I know that there are many people in England who share that aspiration. I'm repeatedly struck by the numbers I meet who yearn for a real modernisation of this country, a way of shrugging off the role of being Europe's awkward squad or America's poodle, which successive governments have seemingly and so willingly adopted. One of my best memories of the last general election campaign was when I realised that the Tories were going to get thumped not beaten, thumped. And that realisation dawned on me, not in the Scottish campaign, but when I did an Any Questions programme in Northampton. And the reason that it dawned on me that here was I, leader of the SNP in Northampton, being cheered to the echo by this Any Questions audience. And sitting beside me was Ken Clark, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the self-proclaimed voice of Middle England, who was being booed off the stage. And I said to him after the programme, you know, you're going to get thumped next week. And he said, oh, no, 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 we might get beaten, but it's going to be narrower than the polls are suggesting. I said, listen, you're going to get thumped. So I suspect that there is a yearning among many people in England that they want more than New Labour has been prepared to offer. They want actually a new radicalism rather than a new conservatism. A change to the whole way and attitude, the post-imperial way of doing things that has clouded English politics for most of the post-war period. Instead of that, at the present moment, they get a government which is all show, no substance. A government which changes the displays in the windows, but not the goods are for sale. A government that follows its focus groups, but is not willing to lead the people. Now, there is a better way of doing things. Scotland's 20th century journey from being, in Tom Nairn's memorable phrase, self-colonised, to being a nation developing self-confidence means that we now stand on the brink of a new century ready to take responsibility for ourselves. That is and could be a liberation for England too. Many wish to take that liberating route, although I note someone who was once in the vanguard of that movement, the director of this very institution, Professor Anthony Giddens, is now swimming against the tide and expressing his fear, or is about to in the New Reef lectures, that it's now important to hold states together for fear that the world becomes too fragmented. I suspect that Professor Giddens is following a long line of thinkers who, when their original thought becomes common sense or commonplace, immediately desert it for pastures new. Or perhaps he's just suffering the consequences of being a guru, which is very difficult burden to maintain in academia or indeed in politics. But I want to suggest to you tonight that for every Giddens moving in the wrong direction, there are a dozen Billy Braggs who are moving in the right direction, and hundreds and thousands of ordinary people who see the sense in asserting national identity while looking positively towards Europe and the wider world. These people are tired of the shrill, the fearful voices of the past, the shrieking Euroscepticism, and those who also would be highly sceptical of the marketing hype of Cool Britannia and the Dome. To these people, I hold out the hand of friendship and offer the example of a small nation that's learning about itself and preparing to launch itself into the world once again. It is an invigorating process, but one which is essential if national progress is to be maintained. The process of Scottish self-discovery is not only a matter for discussion among ourselves and these islands, it's first and foremost a matter for practical action, because the new Parliament, our new Parliament, is only weeks away. I want to talk about some of the key objectives that the SNP has for that Parliament. What underlies these objectives is our positive approach. Our belief is that by showing the Parliament can work on the limited powers that it has, we will encourage people in Scotland to wish to have more power and to be successful over areas where the Parliament has no control at the present moment. Now, for example, in the last fortnight in Scotland, the SNP have been leading the debate in Scotland over a replacement for the Private Finance Initiative. Our proposals are for a Scottish Public Service Trust, and they've received a welcome from trade unionists, from the BMA in Scotland, from academics, and from business people. I have to say it received a much less favourable reception from those who are heavily engaged in Private Finance Initiative themselves. We might have been expecting too much to suppose that those who are making large profits would welcome with open arms the disappearance of the activity which is making them. But we're in active discussion about the detailed operation of the Scottish Public Service Trust with a wide section of society. Now, our proposals are grounded in the need for assets to be held in trust for the people who invest in them and for the wider community, the need to secure better value for money than has been afforded by the Private Finance Initiative, our solution to the free ride at the public purse, as the Labour Party once described the private finance initiative before adopting it themselves, is a Scottish solution designed for the new Scottish Parliament. It illustrates the innovative thinking that is required by the new constitutional situation in Scotland and the fear with which Labour has received the idea in Scotland. It illustrates to me that we are on the right lines. Labour have been defending the indefensible. Now, one of our powerful supporters in this argument has been Professor Alison Pollock of the University of College of London. And the interesting thing is that Alison Pollock, in her extensive studies of the PFI and the damage it's doing to the health service in terms of the overbearing and inflated capital costs on nursing care, on number of doctors, on health service personnel, analysed two major hospital developments. One was in Edinburgh, the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, which we are analysing and using very heavily in this debate, but the other was in Durham. The PFI is being defended with great venom by its supporters. It reminded me of the remark by John McLean that the truth is a virtue that the ruling classes fear. But the point I want to make to this audience tonight is that the PFI, the Public Service Trust Initiative, that we're making in Scotland could equally be applied south of the border. And if, as we hope and believe, it's successful in Scotland, as the Observer newspaper noted in its leader columns, it could light a candle of a different direction on a major issue of policy that could be applied in England as well. And as with the PFI and its replacement, we hope, so with many other actions of Westminster government, we can learn from each other's experience and we can also work together. We have in these islands already an embryo concept in the form of the Council of the Isles. It was conceived out of the peace process in Ireland and is now regarded with favour by the nationalist and unionist communities in Northern Ireland alike. It will be born this year when the devolved parliaments are up and running in Scotland and Wales. However, I would suggest it could reach full development with Scottish independence, a forum not just for agreed developments and practical issues such as transport, but also a clearinghouse for joint positions on European issues. Now, our unionist opponents often argue in Scotland that the United Kingdom has more clout in Europe than an independent Scotland would have. I have to say there's precious little evidence over the last 20 years or so, given the very uneasy relationship that the UK has had with the rest of the continent. Few would seriously argue with the proposition that the small nation of Ireland has had anything other than an unambiguous success out of its European participation. The lesson, perhaps, is that size doesn't always matter in a European context. However, acting as equal partners in the future, England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland could have more influence in a confederal Europe on the many issues of common concern. Now, that would be influenced not just in enhanced voting in the Council of Ministers, although that would be entailed in the proposal, but also in the more important area for European decision-making of four voices being heard in the making of the consensus politics, which is the hallmark of European decision-making. Now, of course, under that formulation, there would be issues where we disagree. And in these cases, each partner in this new relationship would have the right and the opportunity to take a different view. That is the opportunity offered by being neighbours at home and partners in Europe. Scotland's new Parliament will prove itself by positive initiative, not just by undoing the mistakes of the previous administrations. The SNP intends to meet that challenge. There are better ways to manage our health and education services. We propose a health commission to bring people together in health policy in Scotland. We propose to do the same in education, so that we can move away from the continuation of the teacher bashing strategy pioneered by the Tories, continued by New Labour. The SNP in the new Parliament and in the administration will hope to innovate across a wide range of areas, in land reform, in transport, where our infrastructure can be transformed by the public service initiative that I've outlined, in housing, where the emphasis will be on tenants, not on tenure, in the Scottish legal system, where the backlog of modernisation can at last be tackled, and as I've indicated, in education, health, and in the public services. A century ago, Scotland was the wealthiest country in the world. Our entrepreneurs had a worldwide reputation for success, but they also exemplified a sense of civic responsibility. Engaging Scottish business in the task of remaking Scotland is a key objective, but to do so we must ensure that Scottish business is itself assisted and aided by the Parliament. There are limited powers in this area for the new Parliament, but we propose to use them as best they can to their full potential. We are proposing a network of commercial embassies, building on the success of Leichhaven Scotland and turning that success into the Scottish export area and also in integrating tourism within the enterprise framework. We're hoping in the setting of the business rate by the new Parliament that we can reduce the burden which falls unfairly just now on smaller enterprises. We can make the enterprise network work by being more focused and more inclusive. Our plans to develop hotspots of excellence in the knowledge and technology-based industries give an opportunity for new growth, and when we publish our plans for training, we will seek to overcome the ineffective bureaucracies that place a barrier between those who need skilled employees and those employees who seek skills. There's been a tendency in recent years in the UK to assume that somehow democracy is in conflict with operational efficiency. That has emerged in Scotland in the most substantial array of quangos that any civilised country has ever seen. Despite promising a bonfire of the quangos, a phrase first used, I think, by Harold Wilson, if I remember correctly, there's been virtually no reduction in the number of individuals who are selected, appointed by the Secretary of State for Scotland without any effective course to democratic scrutiny. We're now moving into a new era in Scotland. The days of the quangos are coming to an end, and the non-executive boards of no accountability must in many cases go. We'll have a democratic parliament charged with a responsibility of investigating, of scrutinising what is being done in the public name, and we'll have Scottish ministers democratically responsible to a parliament who should be prepared and willing to accept that responsibility. I think the overall effect of our radical approach to reshaping Scotland will be twofold. It will give Scots their first experience of close, democratic, accountable government, and it will begin to move Scotland towards the confidence it needs to build on its own parliament. It's hard to underestimate the importance of self-confidence in this debate. For much of the last 300 years, Scotland's been told it's too small, too distant, too poor, too stupid to govern ourselves. The real Rubicon in this matter is not waiting to be crossed in the future. It was crossed on September 11, 1997, where Scots determined to test the ability of our country against its first parliament in three centuries. That's why the parliament will succeed and must succeed. It must succeed if Scotland is to survive and to thrive, for it is a touchstone of the faith in ourselves. It will succeed because the vast majority of Scots, no matter which party they support, want it to do well and want it to grow and develop in its role. I believe that the success of any political party in Scotland will be judged by that test, the test in the ability to make the Parliament work. I think the New Labour failed that test because ultimately, even with a Scottish Parliament, the ultimate decisions will be made in Mill Blanc or Downing Street. Anyone who had any doubt about that should reflect on last Saturday morning when the result of the Welsh choice for the new First Secretary for the new Assembly was made. And what was made crystal clear was the determination of a Prime Minister who boasts that he is giving people power to retain control by proxy of the institutions in Wales, in London, or in Scotland. Blair just can't bring himself to let go. But let go he's going to have to in the course of this coming campaign. The SNP is Scotland's party, that's our claim. Our decisions are made in Scotland. Our members, our activists and representatives base their political philosophy in the mainstream of the view of social justice going hand in hand with enterprise, underpinned by a strong democratic tradition, social democracy with a Scottish face. Our pursuit of sovereign independence, far from being unusual, is of course the normal status for small countries. And the most successful are those which combine confident individuality with cooperative participation in larger structures. It is that model which the SNP wishes Scotland to follow. Scotland has nothing to fear from independence. Quite the reverse. Independence will allow us to better meet the challenges of globalisation. If we're not in a position to comment on or influence or work with the major economic or intellectual trends of our time, then we would indeed be at the mercy of global influences. A present example would be the development of a single European currency. There is no doubt in the view of the SNP that it's in Scotland's interest to join this development at the first opportunity. Public opinion in Scotland for the first time in any recorded poll in the United Kingdom is showing a level position for and against the euro. The SNP would certainly commit to a referendum on the issue, but equally would endorse membership and fight a referendum on that platform. There is a clarity in the process of Scotland as an independent member of the European Union. But for the last 2 years, that clarity on that issue has been shrouded in the uncertainty which has been required, perhaps, by the balance of forces in Westminster politics. On Tuesday, there was the first almost firm step towards the euro by this government, a step which has been taken very late and, in my view, has not gone far enough. It will be interesting to see if this ultra-tough Prime Minister withstands the barrage from the Eurosceptic press and presses the issue to completion. But in Scotland, that issue is much, much nearer resolution, and the slowness of government cannot but continue to damage the Scottish economy. I noticed that Eddie George had paid a visit to Newcastle yesterday, which was his first sortie into the north of England, since he allowed himself to agree with the remark that unemployment in the north of England was a price worth paying for containing inflation in the south. As far as I know, he managed to emerge from the Chamber of Commerce in Newcastle alive, but he had redefined his position on the issue. Unfortunately, it's too late to redefine the policy which the Monetary Committee have pursued over the last 2 years, which of course has had the effect, as we've seen in the most recent unemployment figures, of increasing unemployment in the north of England and Scotland. The position of high sterling, high interest rates, which may well be reversed with the declaration to join the euro and with the dawning realisation that the economy is tottering on the brink of recession, even if it's changed now, it will not undo the damage that's been done, the substantial damage to the industrial fabric of the economy over the last 2 years. The last 2 years, as far as the euro is concerned, has been a lost opportunity for Scotland. As with the euro, so in so many vital decisions for our future, they'll be made faster and better with more direct involvement if they're made at the Scottish level. However, for all the relationships that Scotland has and all the relationships that we will develop, none will be more important than our relationship with England. Such is the desperation of our unionist opponents in Scotland that they've taken to suggesting that on the achievement of Scottish independence, all trade between Scotland and England will cease. This would come as a surprise to Canada, trading with the United States, or indeed with Austria, trading with Germany. It's a new theory in economics, one which I don't think the London School of Economics would give much house room for. The idea you've got to be part of the same state to trade with each other is something which has never operated in the entire history of world economics. The relationship between Scotland and England goes far beyond economics. Obviously, economic linkages would continue and trading patterns would be unaffected within the context of the single market by the achievement of Scottish independence. But the relationship between Scotland and England is the social union, which we've operated for more than 300 years and indeed before the political union. And that social union will not change merely because political structures change. We'll still visit each other, intermarry, move from one country to another to work. We'll still buy and sell each other's goods. We'll still watch each other's television. Perhaps not the strongest argument I've ever heard, but never mind. We'll still be the closest of neighbours, and I certainly hope the best of friends. In the future, our new relationship will be based on equality, not inequality. This is the only sine qua non for joint discussion and development and cooperation in the future. We can move, in the words of an old SNP saying, from being surly lodgers within the United Kingdom to good neighbours between Scotland and England. The process for of independence for Scotland and for England is the next big adventure in politics. It is the big idea. Those who oppose it from the vested interests of the Union do so because a stronger, more enterprising, more self-reliant and more successful idea, that is, than the one which we are currently engaged. I want to see the process of independence fulfilled, and I want to see it shared with those who live next door to us. The SNP goes forward to the elections on May the 6th, ready to work for the future of our country and for a future productive relationship with our neighbours in England. That is what the SNP as Scotland's party seeks to achieve. That is what Scotland can achieve for the millennium. And it will be a greater monument for all of the people of these islands than any millennium dome. Thank you very much.
A short period of time where Alex has agreed to take queries and questions from the floor, and there are some floor mics roving around, so please wait until a floor mic reaches you. There's a question over there.
Hi. This question is coming from Quebec. We have gone in our province farther down the road of independence than Scotland has yet, and much farther down the road of devolution. We wouldn't call it that. And we have found that the process has not been as filled with harmony between Quebec and the rest of Canada as you would have us hope that the process would be between England and Scotland. A specific question that has raised a lot of concern is what would happen on the day after a hypothetical yes vote on a referendum on independence in Quebec. Now, presumably, not everybody in Quebec and not everyone in Scotland would vote for independence, and so there would be a minority in each place that would still wish to remain part of the parent country. Presumably, also, it has been argued in Canada that the federal government would have a duty to defend the citizenship rights of those Canadians in Quebec that do not wish to be part of an independent Quebec, and I suppose the same argument could be made in Scotland.
Could you sort of draw it to a close?
How do you think that situation would play out in Scotland?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say to you is that Scotland isn't Quebec and Quebec isn't Scotland, and probably an answer to the question, I've never held the view that there's this sort of conspiracy by English politicians to stop Scotland achieving self-determination. In fact, every Prime Minister since Harold Wilson has made it clear that they would accept a verdict of the Scottish people. I mean, even our greatest opponent in living memory would be Lady Thatcher, who certainly did not, before she went to bed every night, pray for Scotland's goodwill, as far as I understand it. In fact, there was only one man in Scotland that ever got the better of Margaret Thatcher, and that was another former moderator. I hope there's no great devotees of the Church of Scotland here today. Duncan Shaw was a good pal of mine. And in the General Assembly, Lady Thatcher was seeking an audience with the moderator, which is the correct precedence, because the moderator is the kingpin of the General Assembly, and the Prime Minister seeks an audience. And Duncan was very keen on Nicaragua, and he was telling the Prime Minister about the evils of American intervention in Nicaragua, and of course Lady Thatcher was getting very impatient, and so after 15 minutes got up to leave, which was a breach of protocol, to which Duncan replied with, "Let us pray, Prime Minister," and kept her there for another half an hour praying about Nicaragua. But even Lady Thatcher, even the greatest opponent of Scottish aspirations in the last generation, at least up until Tony Blair at least, said in her autobiography, I don't quote it word for word, but she said something like, "Scotland is an ancient European nation. If the Scots were to determine on independence, then no English politician, certainly not myself, would gainsay the process." And I think that's a crucial difference between the relationship between Scotland and England and the one you describe in Quebec and the rest of Canada. I mean, I would take the view that the future of Quebec is a matter for the people of Quebec. But I also would take the view that right for Scotland has been acknowledged by every major British politician in the last generation. And I don't think it's... Sometimes in Scotland, you know, there's a sort of containing argument that, you know, there's some folk in Scotland say, well, you know, it would be great to be independent if the English would only let us. Well, the English aren't stopping us. Not even the English politicians, who are not always the best reflection of the plain people of this nation, who I think would have nothing but goodwill and assent for a democratic decision of the Scottish people. So I think the circumstances you describe are quite different. For that reason, a democratic decision by the Scots would be accepted by all political quarters.
Right, could we have a question over here? Could you wait for the mic to... Because otherwise people up top might...
Mr. Salmon, I'm a devolutionist from England, and I agree with almost everything of what you said. Particularly regarding the pressure that the Westminster government's put on local government spending, my simple question to you, which may need a little bit of explanation, is can you let go of power should you get into power in Edinburgh? By which I mean that don't you believe that devolution goes beyond devolution to the nation state? And what is your attitude to allowing Scottish local government the power to choose not just how much money to raise, but how to raise it? And your parliament will have that power very soon, and with the issue of land reform on the agenda, there are other ways to raise finance for local government, which are used in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, that give their local governments the power to choose. And it is, as you say, a way of learning from each other's experience to allow devolution, and we in England certainly look forward to learning from the experience in Scotland on that particular issue.
Well, I mean, firstly, thank you very much for your good wishes. I would say there's three aspects to this in terms of our approach. First is in terms of the Parliament and the Constitution. We believe in a written Constitution, a Bill of Rights. We believe in people being citizens before that written Constitution in a position of equality, as opposed to being subjected to the whims of the absolute power of the Queen in Parliament. As is the state within the United Kingdom, the unwritten constitution. I mean, a Westminster government could technically abolish the right to vote or introduce the death penalty for LSE students. although I suspect the European Court would probably want to question that one. But the importance of a democratic modern constitution with power limited by a written constitution and people being there before that constitution in a position of equality, I think that's the first limitation. Secondly, in terms of how government is administered, I think there's a great deal to be done to make sure that we in Edinburgh don't repeat the mistake of the concentration of government offices and departments that has been done within the United Kingdom. And in this era of information technology, there is no good reason whatsoever for the concentration of massive government departments. You know, there's a public spending debate that goes on interminably between Scotland and England of who subsidises who and all the rest of it. One thing is absolutely certain, if you take the public spending per head across the UK, the area with the highest level of public spending disclosed and undisclosed is the southeast of England. And the reason for that is the concentration of government spending in government offices largely. So we hope to have a programme of decentralisation. We will have a programme of decentralisation of government offices. We've already made announcements in that regard affecting both Glasgow and Aberdeen, and we'll make more announcements before the election comes. In terms of local government, there's two areas I think you've got to look at. One is the area of finance, because unless local government has control over more than about 10% of its finances, it's not going to have real any independence or discretion. Remember, initially, we're going to be in a parliament which itself only controls 10% of its finances. So we're not going to be in a great position to extend powers to local government which the parliament itself doesn't hold. But one area we can look at, and that's the idea of a general power of competence at local level. And there you have a basic reversal of the current situation where unless something's in a statute, the assumption is that local government can't do it. The general power of competence reverses that position. Unless it's specifically prescribed by statute, then local government can do it. That is something the Parliament should do, will do, if we are in administration. The financial aspects and our ambitions, for example, for local income tax, it will really have to wait until we have the financial control in our national parliament in order to be able to devolve it to local government, as indeed it should be, because responsible local government must be financially responsible, just as the national parliament to be responsible should be financially responsible.
There's a question up there in the balcony.
Robert Hazlett from the Constitution Unit. We hear a lot about the role of Scotland in Europe, rather less about what Scotland's place would be within other international organisations if Scotland became independent. Can you in particular tell us whether an independent Scotland, if governed by the SNP, would want to remain within NATO?
Well, I mean, our policy is to be out of the command structure of NATO. We would participate in the Western European Union with Partnership for Peace in the various bodies which cooperate. I mean, the difficulty, obviously, that Scotland has with the NATO position at the present moment is the location of the largest concentration of nuclear weapons in one of the most beautiful areas of Scotland. Now, the present position of Scottish politics, as you're well aware, Robert, is that the SNP are strongly opposed to nuclear weapons. The Scottish Labour Party, by resolution, up until when it was allowed to pass resolutions, always passed resolutions against Trident. There is a strong view among Scottish Liberal candidates, as recently given to CND in Scotland, and indeed among a few Scottish Tories, that Trident is not the most sensible or productive way to go about defence policy. And so I think we can take it there would be a strong and overwhelming view within the context of an independent Scottish Parliament against Trident, and that tends to colour our attitude to the NATO alliance. Now, we're not saying that Trident would have to go the day after independence, the week after independence, the month after independence, but if Trident is to be kept, it would have to be by decision of the rest of the United Kingdom to keep it within their territory. My advice would be it might be an opportunity to get rid of it altogether, but of course that would be a matter for democratic decision of the people of the rest of the United Kingdom. We'd inherit, of course, a treaty obligation to NATO, because we'd inherit all treaty obligations, the ones we like as well as the ones we don't like, and we'd have to negotiate our position from within the context. I'm looking at Scotland, which would have the freedom to participate in international engagements when it seemed in the common interest. And we take a very recent example. The SNP, and I think along with other people, despite reservations initially, supported the concept of the liberation of Kuwait by international effort. And if Scotland had been independent, then I dare say Scottish forces would have been among part of the international alliance which liberated Kuwait from Saddam Hussein several years ago. But I, like many other people in Europe, and the SNP, had the gravest reservations, indeed outright opposition, to the recent bombing of Iraq carried forward by the American President and the British Prime Minister. Now, that decision never, as far as I know, went to Congress or to the Senate. It certainly never went to the House of Commons for definite. And yet, what I think was a fairly disastrous act of international policy, dissolving the Western framework of alliance against Iraq, not securing the readmission of the weapons inspectors, consolidating the position of Saddam Hussein, poisoning the relationship with the Iraqi people, with Britain and America, and of course, killing, as these things tend to do, innocent civilians as casualties of war. I think I look for a Scotland as a small nation of 5 million people, clearly not wishing to be a nuclear power, certainly wishing to cooperate in the international framework where peace and security are involved, but not wanting to be on the end of a phone line from an American president and to say yip every time he has an idea which he wants to pursue.
We got a question here and then one in the balcony, and then I think we'll have to draw it to a close. So just two more, I think. Maybe we could get the mic down for the lady in the balcony at the front there as well.
Brendan,
it's a voice from Ireland.
In recent years, and indeed throughout the Thatcher era, we had a lot of talk about choice. And the one choice which apparently we were never supposed to make was to own things communally and operate them for ourselves. Mm. Now, I'm therefore very interested in the idea of the Scottish National Trust. I wonder if you can tell us what are the assets which you would include within that trust and how you would finance those that are not present in the public domain.
There's a National Trust for Scotland which owns monuments. I should make it clear we're not talking about but it's the Scottish Public Services Trust is what we're calling the concept. It's a construct of it will be a private trust, but it will be charged with public responsibility. So it will be a company limited by guarantee, not as the Labour Party seems to think, a guarantee from the government, but in the normal way of a company limited by guarantee. But the trust will be charged of holding assets in trust for the community. Now, we're talking here about the creation of new assets, bringing into being new infrastructure, new developments in housing and education and in health, the huge advantage it has over the PFI is twofold. One, it can eliminate the soft management costs, which are the shame of the PFI projects. I mean, in some cases, up to 5% of the capital value has gone in what the configuration of management costs as wheels are reinvented every time a private consortium is brought together to fund a PFI project. I mean, Alison Pollock, who I mentioned earlier, for example, estimates that the assumed rate of interest behind the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary was 10%. Now, in this hall, there won't be anybody with a mortgage who I hope is paying more than 6%. Those of you who've got euro mortgages will be paying somewhat less than that, no doubt. But this is ridiculous, a way to conduct public finances. And that means that in the case of the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, a project which costs £180 million is going to be paid for by £900 million of public money over a 30-year period, and not a single brick of that new facility is ever going to be owned by the public of Edinburgh or the general public. Now, Professor Pollock argues, and I agree with her, that the impact of that capital cost bears down on the health budget. So that Royal Infirmary will be a shiny new building, but will have less beds, less nurses, and less doctors working in it. Because the only way to redeem these heavy capital costs is, of course, to bear down on the running costs of the project. Now, there must be a better way than that. We've got, because we don't have the power to redefine the PSBR, which is another route, of course, which I think would be very useful to look at, but the Scottish Parliament won't have that power. So we can launch a public service trust as a means of bearing down on the management inefficiencies of the PFI, of getting a cheaper result, but crucially, with the perspective of holding assets in the community interest, so as at the end of the 30-year period, these assets can be given, returned, residual value to the community. It also offers an exciting prospect in Scotland of bond finance as another option, as well as borrowing and through more conventional means. And there is no reason, for example, if people in the Borders who are campaigning for a new railway shouldn't invest in a 4.5% railway savings instrument, for example, in the Borders, which would allow the Trust to have access to even cheaper forms of finance and make capital projects which are currently impossible possible under that new context. Nothing very original in this. I mean, the Scots' innovation for financial mechanisms last century meant that investment trusts financed a lot of the westward expansion in the United States. We invented joint stock banking. We invented financial mechanisms, and surely it's not beyond our ability to devise a better financial mechanism than the absolute scandal of the PFI. And incidentally, the margins in the private finance initiatives are even worse in England than they are in Scotland, and there's even more scope. And taking the gentleman's point, I think Scotland has a community of identity where a Scottish public service trust, I think, could operate in a Scottish level, perhaps with individual sectors. In England, I would strongly suggest that on a regional basis, on a local authority basis, on a metropolitan basis, that would be an instrument which people would be well worth looking at as a means of escaping the strictures of the United Kingdom Treasury, of whom, of course, it said there's three great lies in life. The cheques in the post, I'll respect you in the morning, and I'm the United Kingdom Treasury, and I'm here to help you.
Final question, Brendan.
Brendan O'Leary, London School of Economics. I was impressed by your moderator jokes, and it occurred to me that I didn't know the answer to the question of what the SNP's position is on the establishment of the Church of Scotland. I'd also like you to tell us whether the SNP is a Republican party, a monarchist party, or both.
Well, the Church of Scotland isn't the established church in the sense that the Church of England is. The Church of Scotland Act merely establishes Churches of Scotland as protected from government interference. It's not the established church in the way that the Church of England is south of the border. We've been having a debate in Scotland about the role of the churches in the new Parliament, if they should have any role. And I wrote to all the denominations and indeed all the religions in Scotland, including Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, Jews, and got from everybody, I think, apart from the Free Presbyterians. I should say they're a very small group of people. That even the Free Presbyterian reply said something like, we don't think there can be a common approach to worship because of our beliefs, but if you're having discussions, we'd like to be included. And I took that as a... I took that as a very substantial advance on previous declared positions. But the more serious point is that all of the denominations wrote a positive reply, and I immediately, as you tend to do in these things, batted it back and said, well, agree a position. Now, why do I think that may be useful? Well, if we contrast it with, say, prayers at Westminster, we have this ritual of a Church of England liturgy and prayers before the start of each Parliament, before the start of each day of Parliament. It doesn't actually mean all that much because it goes through the same prayers, you know, sort of day after day. Now, what one possibility might be that each religion, each denomination in Scotland gets an opportunity of a sort of thought for today spot, so that we might get some cleric regaling against the bombing of Iraq or regaling against Scottish housing conditions, you know, as a small item in the start of a Parliament's agenda. I actually think it could have a substantial and good and reminder to politicians to look above the smoke of battle occasionally. So all religions in Scotland must be treated equally before the Parliament. Whether they have a role in the Parliament or not, they must be treated equally. Certainly, I would, and the SNP would repeal the Act of Settlement as far as it concerns Scotland. We can't obviously repeal it in England. I mean, the Act of Settlement, for those of you who don't know, is the act which bars Roman Catholics from either being or marrying the monarch. I suppose it's a pretty limited restriction on freedom in the sense that not many people get into that position. But nonetheless, it's deeply insulting to a substantial section of the community. One of our advantages, of course, in Scotland, whether you're a Presbyterian or a Catholic or any other religion, you'd find the whole concept of a prime minister appointing bishops. I remember a Yes Minister programme where Jim Hacker was choosing between two bishops, neither of whom believed in God. But what's funnier than a prime minister, whether it be Jim Hacker or Tony Blair, appointing a bishop, is the whole concept of bishops being appointed by politicians. Now, I can say that there's no denomination, no religion, no church in Scotland which thinks that's a good idea. And then the Church of Scotland is established only in the sense of being established and protected from government interference. You had a second question, but I've been going on so much about the churches that... what was it?
Are
again?
You monarchists?
Oh, right. Well, we advocate a reformed monarchy along the Scandinavian line, stripped of the royal prerogative, subject to the written constitution, and we'd offer the people of Scotland a referendum on whether they wish to pursue that option or whether they wished an elected head of state. It would be a decision basically for the people of Scotland. But the party policy is to support a reformed, slimmed-down monarchy on a bicycle, but subject to the provisions of a written constitution. The serious point, of course, is the question of royal prerogative and influence in political decision-making. And the way that the prerogative of the Queen in Parliament has been used to effectively administer absolute discretion, patronage and power within the context of the Westminster Parliament. We are opposed to any House of Lords of any kind, half-lords, whole lords, half-mad, holy-baked lords, any description whatsoever. We actually are for a single-chamber Parliament elected by proportional representation and with the committee procedure, which, to be fair, the Scottish Parliament, the devolved Parliament, is introducing a pre-legislative scrutiny, which we think is far, far more effective, far more democratic, far more inclusive, and has the ability to include wide elements of the community than an unelected revising chamber which bounces things back to the first chamber only to get them reversed in the future. So we would look at a single chamber parliament, democratically elected, subject to a written constitution, and a Scotland where everybody was a citizen, not a subject.
Thank you very much for coming, ladies and gentlemen. There is a reception on the fifth floor in the senior common room, and everybody is welcome to come. Please come and ask Alex further questions.